Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from back in our home station, AM 620 KPOJ at Portland, Oregon, here in the People's Republic of what Bush Sr. called Little Beirut. It's Friday, the first hour of our program, as it has been for going on a little more than 3 years now, as I recall. Our Brunch with Bernie segment, Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, answering your questions. Our town hall meeting of the nation of the air, on the air every Friday. And I think of Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont. He's not a Democrat. He's not a Republican. I think of him as America's senator. He just does such a great job representing all of us. So Bernie will be taking your calls. Area code 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and drop in and say hi. And Bernie, good morning.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us. I guess it's afternoon if you're in Washington.
I'm in Burlington, and it is 12 o'clock noon.
In Burlington, yeah. Okay, great. The occupation of Iraq, I'm really trying not to call it a war, because Bush actually won his war after about 3 or 4 weeks, and we seized the government, and then the occupation began. The occupation of Iraq is ongoing, and Congress looks like it's fixing to do something about it.
Well, you know, Tom, when we talk about Iraq, and we talk about it all the time, I think if you take a deep breath and you step back from the politics and the votes, what you're looking at is an extraordinarily depressing situation. I almost can't imagine anything that I have seen in recent years which is just simply more distressing and depressing than what's going on in Iraq. I mean, every day it's the same thing. Yesterday, more than 100 people were killed in a series of bombings around Iraq, including several in Baghdad. You're seeing a ferocity and a savagery that is just beyond belief of people blowing up kids and driving trucks into marketplaces and so forth. And what you're also seeing is a situation where Bush and his friends have done so much harm that it will take us God knows how many years to undo the damage that these guys have done from day one, when they misled us into the war, when they were totally unprepared for the war, when they have miscalculated everything, when they have wasted billions of dollars on Halliburton and these other no-bid contracts, until today when they still have no exit strategy at all. So I think what you have a situation is where there really are no good options. No one has any good options. We're looking at less bad options, and I think Congress and the American people have reached the conclusion that the less bad option is to bring our troops home as soon as possible. Yesterday, by a vote of 51-47, the Senate followed the House in putting a timetable of bringing our troops home within a year. The President, that bill now has to go to a conference committee to reconcile the House and the Senate language. President indicates that he will veto this bill, showing just how isolated he is from how the American people and people around the world are feeling about this, and we'll go on from there. I think probably the dynamic in the Congress and the most important issue is you're seeing Republicans becoming increasingly nervous about continuing to support the President. We had two Republicans, Gordon Smith from Oregon and Chuck Hagel of Nebraska, voting for this language. I think you have a number of others who are close to coming over, not there yet. But I think when they go home to their districts and they talk to their constituents, they're going to find not only do the people of our country and their states want to bring our troops home, they're going to understand that the right politics, if they want to get reelected, if they want to preserve the Republican Party, that they're going to have to walk into that White House and say, Mr. President, we're parting company with you. This war has been a disaster, and we're going to fight to bring the troops home. And when that happens, the war will be over.
Do you think, Bernie, that right now, neither in the House nor in the Senate is there a veto-proof majority?
Correct.
Do you think that as this continues to move forward and as there's positive
public response to this. And I know for both of us, this isn't fast enough. But hey, it's better than nothing. Do you think that a veto-proof majority will emerge over the next few weeks or months?
No, I don't think it'll work that way, Tom. I think rather what will happen is that a number of Republicans will simply walk into the White House and maybe indicate that they're prepared to vote for a veto override. But ultimately, when the president sees that support from members of the Senate and the House are no longer with him, he will initiate the policies to end the war. That's where I think the dynamic is. I don't think he's going to be beaten on an override per se. I think what will happen is internal pressure within the Republican Party will force Bush to change his policies. So that would be like my political guess.
Yeah, this would be more like when the Democrats sat Lyndon Johnson down and said,
exactly,
and told him that he was not going to run for
a
second term.
That's right.
Yeah.
It would be more like that. So that's an issue out there. And I agree with what you just said. There are many of us. I'm on the strongest legislation in the Senate to bring our troops home. What the Senate did is not as strong as I would like it to be. But I think people are very, very wrong in thinking that this is not significant. There was a reason why Dick Cheney, was in the Capitol the other day. If the vote was a tie, he was prepared to cast the deciding vote in support of the Republican effort to take out the language about troop withdrawal. So, believe me, the president considers this to be very, very significant, and I think the American people should feel that as well. We're making progress. We got a long way to go. We got to keep up the pressure.
And clearly, Cheney had miscalculated if he was assuming that he was going to be needed. We have just two, 3 minutes here before we have to take a break. And a couple of topics I wanted to get on to: global warming, the budget, and veterans needs. I'm also, on top of that, though, I'm just really curious, following up on Iraq, the King of Saudi Arabia has now come out and called the U.S. presence in Iraq an occupation and condemned it. What's your take of the significance of that?
Well, I mean, I think it's just an indication of the increased loss of support that Bush is seeing all over the world. I mean, even staunch buddies of his, like the royal family of Saudi Arabia, is distancing itself. But having said that, what we in fact need is Iraq's neighbors, including Saudi Arabia, including the other countries in that region, to play a very, very strong role in bringing stability to Iraq. While we can all agree that Bush's policies have been a disaster, that is the reality. And we got to figure out where we go from here. And one of the components of a solution is for the neighborhood, so to speak, around Iraq to begin to work with that country to bring some stability there, to bring the warring factions together.
Indeed. Well said. Global warming.
Very briefly, there has been, in terms of the election, a significant change in attitude in Congress toward global warming. I have introduced what is perceived to be the strongest anti-global warming legislation, S-309, which would reduce emissions to 1990 standards by the year 2020 and lower them by 80% by the year 2050. I think you're going to see a lot of movement in this Congress toward energy efficiency. We have huge potential in that area. You're going to see a significant step forward in terms of sustainable energy. I was just reading the other day, Tom, in Germany last year, they installed 80,000 units of solar paneling on rooftops in Germany. Do you know how many we did in the United States?
No.
Less than 10,000. Most of them in California and some of them in New Jersey, almost none around the rest of the country.
Yeah.
So the potential for solar is just extraordinary. We've got to develop policies including tax credits and rebates for those people who want to install solar. There's a lot of potential in terms of both large and small-scale wind turbines. The price of those things are going down. The truth is, I think that breaking our dependency on fossil fuel and moving to energy efficiency and sustainable energy is not quite as complicated as some people think it is. I think we can do it. It's going to take a massive grassroots movement, a lot of effort on the part of the Congress, but I think we can transform the energy system in this country and in the process halt global warming and hopefully reverse that.
Amen. From your lips to God's ears. And quickly, on the budget and veterans needs.
In veterans areas, I just met the other day along with other senators with all of the veterans organizations, and there is an understanding that given the huge needs facing the VA and veterans health care, we are making some real progress. I think at the end of the day, it has to go from the Veterans Committee to the Budget Committee, the Appropriations Committee, blah, 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 blah. But at the end of the day, you're going to see the largest veterans budget that we have seen in many, many years, desperately needed. We have got to make sure that those soldiers come back with all kinds of wounds, with traumatic brain injury, PTSD, get the care that they are entitled to.
Yeah, well said. Senator Bernie Sanders, it's our Brunch with Bernie segment on the Tom Hartman radio program, the first hour of every Friday, noon Eastern Time, 9 a.m. Pacific Time. Bernie will be taking your calls at 866-303-2270, our telephone number. You can drop into our live chat room at TomHartman.com. The Tom Hartman radio program, news without conflicts of global corporate interest. For your brain, the Tom Hartman radio program. However, it does not lead to stiff thinking. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us answering your calls. Our number is 866-303-2270, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Kevin in Trumbull, Connecticut. Hey, Kevin, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Senator Sanders. It's great to talk to both of you. I'd just like to ask Senator about Saipan and the deregulations in labor and immigration that occurred there.
Kevin, I didn't quite hear that. Can you say that again, please?
I was wondering if you could comment on the deregulations that occurred in Saipan over labor and immigration, mainly because of Tom DeLay, and why Congress hasn't acted to reverse those.
The island out in the Pacific where Tom...
Right. Actually, I believe that Congress... to the best of my knowledge, is beginning to undo that damage caused by delay. Sometimes things take a little bit longer than you think. Pelosi has been Speaker for about 3 months working on a number of issues, but to the best of my knowledge, that is, in fact, on the agenda. Obviously, you want strong labor standards, minimum wage standards, workers' rights standards that all Americans have also to be in our territories.
Cliff in Fountain Valley, California. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
I'm honored to be able to speak with you guys today. Senator Sanders, if Bush vetoes the Iraq spending bill or Iraq spending supplement, Congress doesn't have to pass him any money, does it?
Does Congress have to develop another budget? Well, I guess technically it doesn't. Will Congress? Yeah, it will. I don't think anybody is of a mind that we simply not provide any money to the troops who are there. My view is that we want to bring the troops home as soon as possible, but while they are in harm's way, I think it goes without saying you've got to give them all the protection that they need. What the process will be, Chris, is there's going to be a conference committee within a week, I'm sure, coming up with reconciliation language between the House and the Senate on Iraq and other matters. It will go to the president. The president says he's going to veto it. There will be an override effort. We will not be able to override the president. We don't have the votes to do that. And Congress will come up with another budget, and we will see what that budget will contain.
Matt in Charlevoix, Michigan, my mother's hometown. Matt, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, hi, Tom. Pleasure to speak to you again. I talked to you, I believe, a week ago. I'd like to ask the senator, if Bush starts a war with Iran, does that spell the end of congressional oversight and ongoing congressional investigations?
I have legislation in, and in fact other people do. I know Senator Byrd does, Senator Webb does, I do, and I think in the House there's legislation, which makes it very, very clear that President Bush does not have the authority to unilaterally start a war with Iran. I mean, that would be, in my view, a disaster from a public policy point of view, but more importantly, from a separation of powers and a constitutional perspective, that would prevent provoke a huge constitutional crisis. And I personally made that clear to Secretary Rice. I know other people have. I frankly don't think that that's going to happen. It would be a disaster if it did.
Ellen in Brattleboro, Vermont, you're live with Bernie Sanders, and thanks for listening to WKVT.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Senator Sanders, I have an issue very near and dear to my heart, something that I have put many, many hours in, and millions of Americans have, is impeachment. I know it's not a favorite topic of politicians these days, and yet I cannot understand why, when I look at the reasons why Nixon was impeached, that pales in comparison to what the crimes and misdemeanors committed, and the evidence is everywhere. I don't understand. People say give it 2 more years, he'll be gone. That's 30% of the amount of time that this man has been, that these people have been in office, and my God, what they've done in that amount of time. 2 more years is too long, and the country, everything that this man has touched, he's destroyed. I mean, every business venture.
Is there a question there, Ellen?
I think I've got the question.
The question is that why are people so hesitant to do it? It is so. It is the Constitution.
First of all, I mean, I think there is a process, and what the process is about, you know, just jump up one day and do impeachment right now, after 6 years of having a rubber stamp House and the Senate, what you are seeing every single day in a number of committees are serious investigations for the first time about what Bush is doing. You can't just, you need some factual information behind you. That's number one. Number two, while some people think that impeachment might be the most important issue facing this country, other people believe that bringing our troops home from Iraq, making sure that 47 million Americans who have no health insurance maybe begin to get that, deal with the crisis in global warming. And if you're dealing only with impeachment, you're going to have pretty much a government which is at a standstill focusing on that issue. And last of all, if you impeach George Bush, you're going to have Dick Cheney as president of the United States. But I'm not sure that that's a great step forward for democracy.
27 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls at 866-303-2270. The Tom Hartman radio program. Talk radio for the rest of us.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
It's the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
Air America Radio, the Tom Hartman Program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls the first hour of every Friday. Jeff in Tacoma, Washington, you're live with Senator Sanders.
Hey, Bernie. My question is about the Employee Free Choice Act. I know it's in front of the Senate right now, and I'd just like for you to explain to people who maybe don't know what it will do for us, what it will do for workers and workers.
Very good, Jeff. Very important question. What we're seeing in America now is the significant decline of the middle class. For millions of workers, wages are down. Most middle class families need two people to bring in a paycheck to pay the bills. Poverty in America is increasing, and the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider. Tom, I don't know if you saw an article in the New York Times yesterday, which by David K. Johnson, who's a very good writer, who talked about how the wealth, how income disparity in America is growing wider, and the people on top are just doing phenomenally well, while most other people are struggling.
Yeah, I ranted about it at some length, actually.
It's a good rant. It's an issue we need more discussion on. But to answer Jeff's question, there are a number of reasons why working people are struggling in America today and are seeing in many cases a decline in their income. One of them is our disastrous free trade policies. And Congress, by the way, is going to be addressing that very, very soon. And I will be active in saying that the time is long overdue to change, fundamentally change our trade policies. Number two, the reluctance of Republican Congress to raise the minimum wage to anything resembling a living wage. And the third is the decline of trade unionism in America. And that has there are a lot of reasons for that. What the legislation that Jeff is talking about, the Free Choice Act, is that right now when workers are trying to organize a union, as often as not, employers and very sophisticated lawyers are able to defeat union organizing efforts in rather unscrupulous ways. They're able to fire the most active pro-union people in the shop. They're able to take people into a back room and just propagandize them and threaten them and so forth and so on. But this legislation simply says, and this is what exists in Canada, it exists in Great Britain, if a majority of workers sign a check card that they want to belong to a union, they will have the union. And furthermore, if after a certain period of time the company refuses to negotiate a first contract, which happens very, very often, there will be a binding arbitration mechanism. This is a step forward to help working people fulfill their constitutional rights of being able to join a union at a time when the National Labor Relations Board has been extremely anti-union.
Gene, well said. Gene in Napa, California, listening on the Quake. Hey, Gene, welcome. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Good day, gentlemen. At home here, we are faced with Bush turning the Justice Department and FBI into his own secret police, but still, I'm very concerned about challenging the Bush machine directly on its PNAC goals of empire and the foreign policy. So my question is, when will the Houses of Congress challenge the many bases and huge embassy built in Iraq, as these represent the realization of PNAC goals of empire and the use of uncontrollable mercenary forces for protection of them?
Well, I think that, number one, obviously, the immediate concern is ending the war in Iraq and bringing our troops home. I think many of us know that in Iraq there is an effort to build a huge embassy right there, and I think there are some of us who just do not want to see that kind of embassy being built, and we want it to be cut down substantially.
Bob in Seattle on Talk 1090. Hey, Bob.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. But my real concern is Blackwater, this private corporate army that Don Rumsfeld set up. These are non-accountable, non-allegiant troops that I don't know who they're allegiant to. When I went into the military, I took an oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States and to defend our form of government. I find it rather threatening that we now have a private fifth column that doesn't have an allegiance to our Constitution or to our form of government, and apparently comes under the direct command of the commander-in-chief. Is Congress going to do something?
Yes, I think you will. I think, well, as you may know, Bob, it is not just private contractors in Iraq and in the military. We have a president now who would like to privatize as much of the federal government as he possibly could. And I think that that is a disaster for a number of reasons. I think it's an especial disaster in the military because it is demoralizing, I think, in a situation where you have our soldiers whose lives are on the line every day, who are not particularly well paid, are working alongside private contractors who in many instances will make a lot more money than they do doing work the military people used to do. So I think your point is a very good point. Rumsfeld has tried to privatize a significant part of the military. I think that's a mistake, and I think it is being looked at right now in Congress.
Robert in Baltimore, Maryland, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Senator.
Hi.
Senator, how can we get rid of these interim U.S. attorneys who were appointed without confirmation? Can Congress challenge their legality? And if Gonzalez is removed, can we use the confirmation hearings for the next attorney general to accomplish these attorneys' removal?
Well, that's a good question, Robin. I don't know all the answers to that. What I do know right now, and again, I want people to understand, you know, when people get, oh, politics is all crap, I'm not going to get involved. Trust me, in a million years you would not be having the hearings that you're having right now in the Senate with Senator Leahy and in the House with Congressman John Conyers beginning to question raising the whole issue of what happened to these eight U.S. attorneys. Were they fired for political reasons? Were they fired because they were too aggressive going after Republicans? Were they fired because they were doing the job that they were asked to do rather than being political hacks for the Republican leadership? Those questions would not have been asked if we didn't have a change in leadership. I think what you know, Robert, is legislation has now been already passed in the Senate, I suspect in the House as well, which removes that language from the Patriot Act, which the Bush administration exploited, which prevents that from ever happening again. And right now what you're having is ongoing investigations, which may, in fact, lead to the profound repercussions of the resignation of the Attorney General.
Lou in Fayetteville, Arkansas, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, how are you doing, Senator? It's a pleasure talking to you. I was curious. I've had over 150 letters the editor published, and I've sent about an equal number to my representatives over the last 3 years. And I was curious, is how much attention do the senators actually pay to these letters, and how important is it that their constituents keep writing them, let them know exactly how we think?
Lou, they are very important. They are very important. I mean, important in a couple of senses. Somebody pens a letter, and you know it comes from somebody, that does mean something. And I'm not going to say that just because you got a letter, you're going to change policy. But if it's a personal letter, it means something. If a member of the House or Senate receives hundreds and hundreds of letters or emails, it also has an impact. That's one of the reasons that groups like MoveOn.org have been as successful as they have been, because they're showing that on issue after issue, you have millions of Americans who are concerned, and you know what? Congress listens to that.
Gloria in Long Beach, and listens to phone calls, too, as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's very important. Gloria in Long Beach, California, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yes, I'm wondering, while everything is going along just smoothly and wonderfully, and the accomplishments of the Senate now, why is no one talking about the undercurrent of the overall plan of the neocons in Bush's administration? I mean, they were all over the place. The man who advised him about this new surge propaganda is Richard Kagan. He's on the list of the neocons who made up the Project for the New American Century. This is very important. This is treasonous to have people like that.
Is the bottom line, Gloria, that you're concerned about what might happen if there's a Persian Gulf incident? Is that
right? I know there's going to be one, because that's what they're capable of doing. They have no intention of leaving the Persian Gulf.
Let me just say this. I mean, yes, what are people doing? I mean, what people are doing is that there was a vote yesterday in the Senate and one previous to that in the House to begin bringing our troops home from Iraq. Is it as quick as I would want it to be? No. But that is not insignificant. What are people doing? There are hearings every day, whether it's the U.S. attorney, whether it is on no-bid contracts, whether it is on the FBI abuse of constitutional rights. So I think there is some progress being made. And I think we just got to continue to plow forward to make sure that our government represents all of the people and not just wealthy and powerful special interests.
So how do you expect Congress would respond if, for example, an American warship came under fire from an Iranian warship?
I don't want to speculate, but I certainly think that going to war with Iran, in fact, I have language, as I think I've mentioned earlier, have language in, as do other senators, to say that it would be unthinkable for the president to go to war with Iran unless he came to the Congress.
Yeah, and that's really what we need, is for your legislation to be passed. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. Our number 866-303-2270. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, our Brunch with Bernie segment, the place where despair is not an option. Get active, my friends.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
it's the family that grieves for a lost loved one. It's the soldier who won't leave till the job is done. It's the addict trying to turn his life around. It's picking yourself up off the ground when you've been knocked down. We carry on when our lives come undone.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth in Broadcasting for a Change in America. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us taking your calls. Dan in Morrell Bay, California. You're live with Bernie Sanders, and thanks for listening on KYNS.
Yes, Senator. I was wondering if you could tell me there seem to be 22 Republicans and 11 Democrats up for re-election in 2008, and I wondered if you might comment on what that terrifying arithmetic is going to do to Republicans in the Senate, sort of hinge them away from Bush.
Well, Dan, if we get our act together, we can make significant changes. Right now, the Democrats, with Senator Tim Johnson in the House, will literally have a one-vote majority. And that's not, to say the least, a very strong majority. I think the Republicans are on the defensive all over this country. I think right-wing extremism has ended. The question now is whether we can put together a strong progressive majority, and you've asked exactly the right question. I think in congressional districts, in states all over this country, we can win sweeping changes. And if we do that, and if we elect a non-Republican president, we can begin not only ending right-wing extremism, but we can move forward to provide health care to all people, to really address global warming, to have a tax system that does not run up the deficit while giving hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks for the wealthiest 1%, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's really what we have got to focus on. I think we've got a good chance to do it if we can sustain a strong grassroots movement, get people involved in the political process.
Jerry in Long Island, New York on WWRL. Hey, Jerry. Jerry? Nope. Okay, Mark in Orange Vale, California. Hey, Mark, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks to both of you for your public service. I really appreciate what you're doing. I'm calling to ask you about sort of the root causes of our interest in the Middle East, particularly to ask Senator Sanders about any plans to do anything about federal financing for our auto-centric lifestyle. Not only do we fund primarily highways and not transit, but the federal government sponsors an awful lot of very important loan programs like FHA, VA, Farm Home. Rather than requiring that they have pedestrian-friendly mixed use that is transit-friendly community design, these will fund all kinds of sprawl. And I've witnessed, particularly in our area, I'm near Sacramento, California, they're building the sprawl as fast as you can swing the hammers.
Yes,
and
you make a very, very good point. And if we are serious about breaking our dependence on oil and fossil fuel in general, it's not only energy efficiency in a big way, it's not only moving towards sustainable energy, it's trying to create communities where, among other things, people can be in a place where they can drive a bike, ride a bike to work, or walk to work rather than having to travel on a congested highway for an hour to get to work. So I think we need that type of urban planning. We need to put federal funds in directions which encourage that rather than just more and more road construction and more automobile traffic. And I think you're exactly right.
Brenda in Farmers Branch, Texas. You're live with Senator Sanders.
Thank you for taking my call. Recently, Al Gore addressed the Senate and mentioned setting up federal guidelines for solar panels for communities that won't allow them.
Yes.
And I live in a community that will not allow them, although they use solar panels for the school zone lights. But they won't let homeowners use solar panels or install solar panels on the roofs of their homes. And I was wondering if Congress is considering Al Gore's suggestion.
Well, I don't know that it's just Al Gore. You're right. That was Al Gore's suggestion, but other people have made that point as well. And the answer is a three-letter word, yes.
If we are serious about moving to sustainable energy, we need a national policy which encourages solar panels and not discourages them. So the answer to your question is yes, Brenda.
Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. You're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator. Senator, I heard on the Lou Dobbs show last night that the Department of Transportation wants to allow trailers coming in from Mexico any point they want without any checks, without any checking a driver's license, loads, checking for drugs or weapons or terrorists being hauled in on these trailers. How can the Department of Transportation, an appointed bureaucrat, overrule Congress and Senate? We have to abide by all these rules as citizens of the United States. Why are they being allowed to even operate like this? Why shouldn't they be tried for treason right on the spot?
Well, first of all, I'm not familiar with what Dobbs was saying. What I can tell you, though, is as somebody who voted against NAFTA and voted against permanent normal trade relations with China, what you're going to see beginning, I think, within the next few weeks or few months is for the first time in many, many, many years, you're going to see a number of us stand up, say no to giving the president fast-track authority with regard to trade. You're going to see a serious fight now to reverse our disastrous trade policies. NAFTA, which is really what you're talking about with Mexico and Canada, has been a disaster for American workers. It has been a disaster for family farmers, small farmers in Mexico. And it is time to develop trade policies which work for working people, which work for lower-income people, and not simply for the CEOs of large corporations. You're going to see more discussion and more action on that issue in the next few months than you have seen in many, many years.
Yeah, this is part of the Waco meeting where they said we'll let Mexican truckers come into the United States even if they're not union members and drive all across the country.
I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, okay. All righty, great. Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thanks so much for being with
us.
Good
to be with you, Tom.
Always great talking with you. It's Senator Bernie Sanders, our Brunch with Bernie segment here every Friday. Up next, Alan Herps, the author of Nuclear Energy Now. Is it time for more nukes?
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Okay, Al Gore says the planet has a fever. Tom Hartman here with you, by the way. The place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, I don't think so. So anyhow, Al Gore says the planet has a fever. We have carbon emissions going into the atmosphere like crazy seems to be one of the major causes of that fever. Much of that carbon is coming from our generation of electricity, which is one of our major forms of energy around the world. And Alan Herbst and George Hopley have written a new book suggesting that the solution is nuclear energy. Nuclear energy now, why the time has come for the world's most misunderstood energy source. Alan has 20 years' experience in utility consulting, a general partner of Utilis Energy LLC, a strategic consulting firm based in New York, and the website is Utilis, U-T-I-L-I-S, energy.com for more information on him. Alan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. You, in the first half of your book, more or less, you do actually, that sounds diminutive, but you do a very good job of describing the problem that we face with regard to energy and why carbon-based fuels are not the answer, from oil to, you know, you even have a chapter about why LNG is not the answer.
Okay, that's correct. We do touch on a lot of different fuels. And, you know, what we're saying is that it's probably not going to, we're not going to rely on one source of fuel for our energy. Part of the argument of the book is that we need a sort of a portfolio of generation assets, which includes nuclear power, which I guess most people don't know currently generates 20% of this country's electricity. And also we're going to have to look at alternative fuels and natural gas and LNG and any other sort of technology-based fuels that we can bring online.
Yeah. The thing that I didn't find in your book that baffles me is if you're promoting nuclear power as something that doesn't produce carbon,
yeah.
how do you address the fact that producing 1,000 tons of uranium fuel, which is about 2% of annual global consumption, but just to use that number, generates 100,000 tons of radioactive tailings, 1 million gallons of liquid waste containing heavy metals, arsenic, and radioactivity, and ultimately 54,000 metric tons of radioactive spent fuel that we don't have any place to put, that the process from initial mining through purification and enrichment to transportation to presumably storage and certainly building the plants is all fossil fuel driven. And there are some out there who are suggesting that nuclear power plants don't produce their first kilowatt of actual pure nuclear energy until they've been in business anywhere between 15 and 18 years because of all that fossil fuel stuff that goes into getting the nuclear power, the nuclear fuel into the reactor and ultimately will go into dealing with it after it's not useful in the reactor.
Sure, that's a pretty complex question. And first, you know, there's no such thing as a free lunch. You know, the world needs more energy, and you're going to get the energy from someplace. Unless we're able to, conservation is part of the solution. Renewable fuels are, again, part of the solution, too. But if you're going to, if consumers want the type of energy we have or use the amount that we currently use or anything close to it, nuclear is one of the answers.
Why?
Because if you don't rely on nuclear, eventually the reactors in the U.S. will their licenses will expire, and eventually they'll be shut down.
So then, why don't we do what Germany has done? Germany offered a tax, not even a tax credit. They passed a law saying that banks had to give mortgages to people to put solar on their house. It was federally guaranteed. It's like a 2% loan for a 10-year period that the utility companies had to buy back electricity from those solar panels at seven times the going rate because that's the cost, the distributed cost of building a new nuclear power plant. They now have enough solar panels just 3 years after they passed this legislation. I mean, huge solar panels on people's houses. And the 10-year period, by the way, for the mortgage payments are roughly equivalent to what you get for selling this at seven times back to the power company. At the end of 7 years, the power company no longer has to pay seven times. They just pay what the prevailing rate is. At the end of 10 years, you own the solar panels, and they have generated enough electricity now in Germany that they did not have to build another nuclear power plant. Why don't we do that?
Well, that's a solution. You know, in California, there's a huge new solar initiative going on right now, and there are solar initiatives in other states, and there are government programs that will help subsidize the cost of installing solar panels. And, you know, the price of those solar panels has come down, and they are more efficient now, and it is a viable alternative. I don't think you can get all the energy we need from solar or other renewables, and that's the issue, that, they will play a role. They're playing an increasing role, but you're not going to get the magnitude of power that you're looking for from solar or wind or other.
Germany thinks they can. Germany thinks they can. I mean, they're talking about their long-term goal is to decommission all of their nuclear reactors, have every building that has a south-facing roof have solar panels on it, looking to wind power. And this is a country that has a fair amount of coal, but they have no oil whatsoever, and they're very serious about becoming energy independent. I mean, it just seems to me like nuclear energy, with all the risks known and unknown, the fact that it is such a dangerous industry that they can't get insurance. We are insuring them, the Price-Anderson Act. And this year we're subsidizing the industry to the tune of $5 billion. I mean, this industry has never been able to exist without taxpayer bailouts. Why even consider it?
Of course, it's a piece of vital infrastructure. Look at France. France has got 58, 59 power plants. They produce 80% of electricity from nuclear power. They've never had any significant accidents, and they are less dependent on foreign oil because of it.
Where are they putting their waste?
They're reprocessing most of their waste.
They were dumping it in French-controlled Pacific Islands.
I'm not sure about that, but the French made a decision many decades ago to reprocess their waste, which is one of the courses of action you can take. And
they reprocess it into what? Nuclear bombs?
They reprocess it into additional to nuclear fuel again, which they use for the reactors. So, you know, that is one of the solutions. The other one is to sort of bury it or contain it somehow.
Well, they've already generated more nuclear waste. You know, this site, Yucca Mountain, that's so controversial, that may or may not happen, will hold, 13,000 or 54,000 metric tons. The entire capacity of Yucca Mountain is 63,000 metric tons.
Mm-hmm.
We're sitting on 54,000 metric tons. We're producing a couple thousand tons a year.
That's where reprocessing comes in. And, Yucca Mountain, they have not received any approval yet from the NRC. There's some figures that it can hold 77,000 tons of waste. There are, a couple other facilities out there holding the waste right now, or it's held on site at various, utilities or at the power plants.
Right, themselves. Well, somebody could fly a Cessna 172 into it and cause an accident that could render a 100 square mile area uninhabitable for 1,250,000 years.
They got
the stuff out in cooling pools with canvas tarps over the top of them.
It's a relatively safe, with a lot of regulatory oversight industry. You know, you mentioned safety, and I'm not trying to get into an argument with you about, nuclear fuel versus other types of energy, but how often do you see refineries explode and blow up? You know, there you're dealing with volatile hydrocarbons under pressure with steam, and there are scores of people killed each year at refineries, let's say.
All the refinery explosions in the world don't add up to one Chernobyl.
Well, Chernobyl was an event that happened, a couple of decades ago, and there are reasons why it was done, why it occurred. There were the Soviet designed reactors were not state of the art, and the procedures that they followed were doing testing, and there were political reasons why they were doing testings, and they really weren't following safety protocols.
We're talking with Alan Herbst. He's the author of Nuclear Energy Now, Why the Time Has Come for the World's Most Misunderstood Energy Source. Sorry to cut you off, Alan, but we only have about a minute left. I want to get your answers and get all this stuff out. Utilisenergy.com is the website. There were interviews back in the 50s with some of the guys who worked on the Manhattan Project who suggested that the Atoms for Peace program, the initial nuclear energy program, really was a way of assuaging the horrible, horrible guilt feelings these guys were experiencing over having just created a device that vaporized hundreds of thousands of people in Japan. Could it be that we have a form of energy here that we just don't need?
No, I think we definitely need it. It provides 20% of our demand for electricity. And if we're going to continue to use electricity, we have to find a portfolio of generation assets that will help us meet the demand that we have for this for electricity.
Alan Hurst. Thank you, Alan. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
The Tom Hartman Radio Program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. The headline from the Associated Press. At Summit, this is the Arab League meeting that's going on right now in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. It's the one where yesterday or the day before yesterday, I forget which, the king of Saudi Arabia referred to the U.S. illegal occupation of Iraq, causing some consternation in the White House, as you may well imagine. This article, going on what happened, let's see, 3:20, today, this morning, I mean, you know, they're 8-9 hours ahead of us. Arab leaders push, no, actually, here on the West Coast, they're 10 or 12 or 11, whatever it is. Anyhow, they're hours ahead of us here in the United States. Dateline Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, Associated Press. Arab leaders pushed ahead with plans to develop nuclear programs, even as they warned of a possible Middle East nuclear arms race created by their powerful rivals, Israel and Iran. On Thursday, the final day of their annual summit, Arab League leaders said they would hold a high-level meeting this summer to review plans for an Arab nuclear industry. Now, our good buddy, King Abdullah II, the dictator of Jordan, the king of Jordan, whatever, called in a speech for the creation of a, quote, peaceful Arab center for using nuclear energy, end quote, to, quote, help build our societies and modernize the realms of science, industry, agriculture, and health, end quote. And then Wael Assad, the League's official in charge of preparations for the meeting, said, close, again, quoting from the AP here, said, closer nuclear cooperation was prompted by fears of Israel's nuclear weapons and Iran's escalation of its program. In other words, the bottom line here, this is all code. They're all saying, yes, we want to have nuclear power plants, even though we're sitting on half the planet's oil and we've got solar power that would make Arizona envious. We want to develop nuclear power plants because it's a reasonable excuse, and actually in some of these plants, the design of them actually is a poor man's way of enriching uranium to the point where you can develop plutonium or just highly enriched uranium to make a nuclear weapon. Is this the direction we want the world moving, and do we want to be promoting it by having nuclear power here in the United States? I think not. And one of the things I think was most revealing, and, you know, thanks to Mr. Herbst for coming on the program, I always appreciate it when people who have views that differ from mine are willing to engage in a little discourse with us. But his point that he made several times was that 20% of our power comes from, our electric power right now comes from nuclear energy. Listen to Jimmy Carter on July 15th, 1979. And we, by the way, would have had this if those hostages hadn't been held until Ronald Reagan put his hand on the Bible, thus, you know, taking Jimmy Carter from being way ahead of the in the polls just a month before the election to sinking in the polls in the weeks before the election, and then us selling the Iranians missiles and spare parts in exchange for hostages. And the only hostages they'd ever had were our diplomats in 1980. In any case, Jimmy Carter in 1979, remember, 20% of our power right now coming from nuclear energy. This is what Carter was setting up.
Moreover, I will soon submit legislation to Congress calling for the creation of this nation's first solar bank, which will help us achieve the crucial goal of 20% of our energy coming from solar power by the year 2000.
20%. What an amazing coincidence. And what did Reagan do? He, you know, he comes in on the back of big oil and big construction. You know, some of the contractors in Iraq also participate in the manufacture of nuclear power plants. And, of course, you've got the company that owns NBC as one of the major suppliers to the nuclear power industry. And they came in with the Reagan administration, and somehow those solar panels that were up on the roof of the White House that Jimmy Carter had put up there as a good example to America haven't been there since. Taken down during the Reagan administration. The programs to create the solar bank, taken down by the Reagan administration, never put back since. The national energy policy, a rational national energy policy, what a novel idea, taken down, not put back since. And so what happens? What's the consequence of this? A, you've got folks, you know, running around saying, oh, well, let's have more nukes. And B, as in nuclear power plants, and B, you've got this increasing dependence upon foreign oil, which is leading us to adventures, let's say euphemistically, in foreign nations, particularly in the Middle East, where now over 3,000 of our men and women have died, and best guesses, over 600,000 Iraqis have died, and we have become the pariah of the planet, the absolute pariah of the planet. Is this the direction that we really want to move as a country? I can't believe that most Americans want to move in the direction of more nuclearization of the United States and the world. It just doesn't make sense. I mean, we have such an abundant level of solar energy.
This, our civilization was powered by solar energy up until about 200 years ago, and within the next 100 years, it's going to begin to be powered with solar energy again, probably a whole lot shorter than that, and frankly, it's enough. It's enough. Wave power, wind power, solar power, it all comes from the sun. It's enough. I'm going to tell you about what happened in the airport last night. Interesting little story. In just a second. 27 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Welcome back to the radio support group of, by, and for We the People of the United States of America. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Last night, yesterday I was in San Francisco all day. Did the show in the morning from the Quake, and that afternoon at the Fox Theater in Redwood City, we did a live thing with John Scott, who's their afternoon guy, and it was great. A lot of fun. And afterwards had dinner with, Bob Agnew, the guy who runs the radio station, and Sam, one of their star sales guys. And finally made it back to the airport at 9 p.m. And for somebody who gets up at 3 a.m. every morning, you can imagine I was a little tired. And then my plane was delayed by about a half hour. I ended up getting back home about 1:30 in the morning. And I say that not by way of complaining, but by way of letting you know what my state of mind was as I was staggering through the airport at 10:30 in San Francisco last night waiting for my delayed flight. And, I was so tired that everything just kind of seemed a little surreal. It's that, just kind of stoned without being stoned, if you know what I'm talking about. And as I'm walking down the aisle in this very busy airport, a lot of people, sitting on the floors and on the counters and, whatnot, all over. And as I'm walking down the aisle, I hear this voice, that comes out of the ceiling that says words to the effect of, and I wish I'd written it down or had a tape of it because I've heard it a million times in airports. It's sort of like the fasten your seatbelt thing in the airline. You after a while, it just kind of becomes normal. But this voice that says words to the effect of, the Homeland Security threat level is elevated to orange. Please be alert for suspicious packages. Please do not leave your luggage unattended. The Homeland Security threat level is orange. And as I'm walking along, I'm thinking, what are we afraid of? 19 guys. Let's just assume for the moment, and I can argue against it as well as anybody else, but let's, however it happened, let's just assume for a moment it was 19 guys with box cutters. 19 guys got lucky or got skillful, one or the other, or a little bit of both. And we have been terrified as a nation. We're the entire, the San Francisco airport is threat levels orange. Look out, be afraid. Did we do this after Tim McVeigh blew up the Oklahoma City bill? I mean, that was an act of terrorism, killed several hundred Americans. I would submit to you that one of the big differences was that there wasn't a camera trained on the Oklahoma City building as the bomb went off. Had there been, and had it been replayed 100,000 times on television over the next couple of years, we'd all probably have national post-traumatic stress disorder about that from a Christian terrorist trying to bring about the end of the old order and the beginning of the new. But 19 guys from an organization, Al-Qaeda, that at that time had at most, according to the CIA's estimates, at most 20,000 loyal supporters around the world. And that was before they hit us on 9/11. And after they hit us on 9/11, it probably dropped in the initial days to fewer than 5,000 because most of their own loyal supporters were horrified by what they had done. It's one thing to blow up the Marine barracks in Beirut. Hey, you're occupiers in our country. It's a whole other thing to take out a huge landmark. I mean, The world was horrified. And when we look at how Spain responded to a terrorist incident in Spain, and how England, the United Kingdom, responded to a terrorist incident in the United Kingdom, well, they've gotten a little hysterical. But again, I think Tony Blair is milking this for political gain the same way George W. Bush is. Do we really need to be this terrified about, you know, a small band of crackpots that we could have tracked down when the Taliban in Afghanistan was willing to turn over Osama bin Laden to the international community to be tried, to be tried for this crime? And we could have all had closure and Al-Qaeda would have been dispersed and that would have been the end of it. It just, you know, suddenly hit me. We have become a nation terrified. And what happened to America? Seth in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Seth, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hey, Tom, thanks so much. Hey, I agree with you 100% about alternative energy as opposed to nuclear. We could also be getting 20% of our energy from tidal and geothermal sources with off-the-shelf technology that we could install tomorrow if we had
another 30 or 40% from willpower, from wind power.
Yeah, right. Well, what I wanted to tweak you on was another one of these threat-level perception issues. You said about half an hour ago that a Cessna 172 flying into a nuclear plant would could make hundreds of miles of territory.
No, not into the plant, into the pool of water outside the plant where they hold the spent fuel.
Yeah. You know, I'm a light plane pilot. My plane weighs less than an SUV does. And you'd have to fly a 747 into that pool to splash enough radioactivity around to do any significant damage.
You know, you're probably right. I stand corrected. I'm also a private pilot, and you're right.
When Corey Little flew into that condo in New York,
it took out one apartment building.
His Cirrus went through the exterior curtain wall and didn't even get past the interior walls.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. But the point is that Mohammed Atta, if the records left behind are accurate, one of his first targets was going to be the Indian Point nuclear power plant in New York, and he wasn't going to target the reactor dome because he knew that was pretty impenetrable. He was going to target the cooling pools, and because they are very lightly protected, it wouldn't produce a nuclear explosion. What it would produce is a cloud of radioactivity that would have rendered all of New York City uninhabitable. It would have been a far more horrific thing for all of us than the World Trade Center. And he scratched it off his list because he just assumed that the thing was protected by missiles, by some sort of, there had to be some sort of protection for it. And it turns out that there wasn't then, and there isn't now.
Right.
And these guys are running around going, we're safe. By the way, we've got a wand grandma here at the airport. And it's like they're doing all the assuming, first of all, that there is some sort of horrible threat out there. And I think that our actions in Iraq have increased the probability of it. I think we could have done away with it right after 9/11, when even the Muslim world was on our side, when they were holding candlelight vigils in Tehran in support of the U.S. government. When the Iranian government was passed a note to Bob Ney, the only Farsi-speaking member of Congress, saying, we're willing to help you with Iraq, we're willing to help you with the Israeli-Palestinian problem, and all this stuff. We could have solved this problem, but even if that's the case, even if there are people out there who want to get it, come on, wanding grandma at the airport and say,
the threat level is now orange. The homeland terror threat level is now orange. Beware, be afraid, be very afraid.
I mean, come on, give me a break. Start inspecting the cargo underneath the plane I'm flying in. It's like it's the Bushies, it's all about appearance, and it's not at all about what's real. It's just and the true threats to us are just blown all out of proportion. Seth, well, good point, well made. Thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Ed in San Juan Capistrano. Hey, Ed, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I guess it was, I got 2 points here, but it was one man at the head of this thing who killed 3,000 people on 9/11.
One
man who's just killed 3,000 of our soldiers, but it took him 4 or 5 years. Another 3,000 of our citizens. This nuclear thing that you're talking about, we just built 22,000 houses here in San Juan, and it's against the law to put anything solar on the roofs.
Now,
we've got another 16,000 going in, and it's against the law to put solar on the roofs. Who is that guy kidding?
Is that a city ordinance, or are these like neighborhood
both
guidelines?
You know. And it's who are we fooling?
That's crazy.
Oh,
yeah,
California's got solar power. Yeah, maybe someplace in the woods someplace. But I tell you, we don't want to ruin the atmosphere of these beautiful homes that we're putting in, these million-dollar homes. And,
crazy.
You know, our nuclear power plant, getting back to that, is built in San Diego, is built on an earthquake fault.
Yeah.
And the only nuclear reactor that we have in Orange County is at a local college.
Yeah.
It's a local college, and I got news for you. It empties into a swamp. Have a good day, Tom. Think about it.
Thanks a lot, Ed. I mean, you know, this is when we lived in Atlanta, we lived in a suburb up in Roswell, north of Atlanta, and East Cobb County for a while as well. But this neighborhood we lived in Roswell, I thought, you know, we should plant vegetables instead of a lawn. You know, I just think grass is like stupid and wasteful. Let's plant vegetables. Turns out that the neighborhood association has a rule against vegetables in your life. Turns out a lot of communities in the United States say your front yard must be grass. You know, come on, what? I'd like to grow some food here. And communities say, no, you can't have solar panels. 10 years ago, I wrote a chapter for a book that Marianne Williamson compiled called America, Imagine What America Could Be Like in 50 Years If We Do Everything Right. The short title is Imagine, edited by Marianne Williamson. And the chapter I wrote was about community energy. What if we decentralized energy? What if everybody's energy came from no more than a mile away from them? What if every house had solar panels and every neighborhood, if that wasn't enough, had a local, you know, biofuel station or a geothermal station or a giant windmill or whatever? And, you know, the problem is it would put all these giant electric utilities out of business. And it wouldn't surprise me at all to find that the heavy hand of Enron was lobbying back when these laws were passed to have these communities say, no, you can't have solar panels on your roof. They have to be 30 miles down the road and owned by Enron. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
The days come easy and the moments pass slow. And each road leads you where you wanna go. And if you're faced with a choice and you have to choose, I hope you choose the one that means the most to you. And if one door opens to another door closed, I hope you keep on walking till you find the window. If it's cold outside, show the world the warmth of your smile.
It's your minimum daily adult requirement of Saturday, the Tom Hartman Program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Ellen Ratner on the line with us from the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, the press secretary, or acting press secretary, Dana Perino, said the president has confidence in Mr. Gonzalez, and the Justice Department has been working hard to respond to the request for documents. Now, today there was a five.
Did he say that they're doing a heck of a job?
Yeah, doing a heck of a job, Brownie. You got it. Today there's a 5-hour closed-door meeting with the House and Senate Judiciary and officials of the Justice Department. So I think that there's going to be a lot of fur flying this afternoon on that. And Arlen Specter, Senator Specter, was at the press club and saying that he is not going to demand any resignation from Gonzalez until he essentially has his day in court. That means testifying, and that he certainly has some questions. That coming from a Republican.
Well, and that's actually a reasonable position. But for a Republican to say something reasonable, that's a pretty significant.
I mean, it's a very damning statement. Yes.
Yeah. What else is going on in Washington?
There, well, the president today visited Walter Reed, and he is going to actually be making a statement in almost exactly 1 hour from now about conditions, et cetera. Don't quite know what he's going to say, but apparently the leak from the White House is that, you know, things are looking very good. There's now color television, et cetera, et cetera. So it will be interesting to see how that gets spun. In the understatement of the year department, the GAO issued a report today that's the Government Accountability Office, that the Iraq Ministry of Defense challenges remain in order for the Minister of Defense that's in Iraq to achieve self-sufficiency. Training has been hampered by lack of fuel, electricity, personnel, and material support.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. Now, let me ask you something about impeachment here, Ellen. We had, you know, Bernie Sanders on in the last hour, and one of the listeners called and said, you know, hasn't this guy done enough that we can impeach him now? And Bernie kind of danced around it, as pretty much all the Democrats are doing. And I have a take on this, and it's not based on any conversations I've had with Bernie. So this is purely my take, because he and I have not discussed this off the record. All of our conversations have been out loud on the radio. But my take on it is that the way that you impeach a president is by demonstrating not just to that small, what might be referred to as the P1 constituency, you know, the primary political advocates and activists, the 5 or 10 or 15% of Americans who really truly follow the news, the political news, not just convincing them of high crimes and misdemeanors, but convincing at least a third to a half of the American public that high crimes and misdemeanors have happened, and that you do that by having investigations, very serious, very thoughtful, very methodical investigations, which is what Bernie said. And what he didn't say, but I think that this is the elephant in the room that none of the Democrats want to speak about, is that if those investigations demonstrate and do so in a very, very public way, I mean, these investigations are getting a lot of media coverage, that high crimes and misdemeanors were committed, that impeachment then becomes on the table. The problem is, if any Democrat were to right now publicly say out loud, yes, we're hoping that some of these hearings will lead to crimes that are impeachable, that all of a sudden the Republicans would get up on their high horse and go, ah, we knew it was a witch hunt, and they would actually lose credibility and they wouldn't be able to continue the investigations. Am I reading the political calculus here right?
Well, I don't know that the issue about impeachment will have to come if the Democrats make a calculated judgment about the year 2008. Does this help them to do an impeachment procedure for 2008, or does it hinder? Then, and also going on at the same time, they're not mutually exclusive, this issue of step-by-step investigation, building a case, and beginning to find material. Who knew when these guys got fired that the Gonzalez thing was going to turn up as much really solid material as it has? And
right, well,
so
who knew when they busted the Watergate burglars that would lead to the impeachment of Nixon?
Exactly. And so if you do, let's say, 10 investigations, one going on around health care issues, another going on about military training, a third going on about Gitmo. In other words, if there's 10 investigations going on and one of them or two of them turns out to be very, very serious materials or non-truths or something like that, then you may begin to build your case. But it's going to take that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think, you know, as, you know, people say, who do you, last night somebody at this thing I did at the Quake, somebody said, who do you support for president? And I said, well, you know, John Edwards, I love Dennis Kucinich's perspective on things. I think John Edwards is the most viable candidate that I support. But any of them are fine because, frankly, on the Democratic side, because, frankly, I think it's about we the people. If enough of us get engaged, if enough of us get involved, if enough of us get out there and get active, change will happen, and it will happen regardless of who's in the White House. And I would say it's the same thing. Regardless of what the Democrats in the Senate and the House of Representatives are saying about whether or not they're going to impeach Bush, if enough people are convinced that he has committed impeachable crimes, they're going to have no choice.
The idea is, I think, to begin to assemble data. And again, whether you impeach somebody, and then if you impeach him, you then get your vice presidential candidate, or you have the vice president becoming
president. Well, you
impeach
both of them. I mean, both of these guys are complicit in these crimes.
But what I'm saying is that, again, if there's enough you know, as there is on the war, if there's enough push on certain issues, things are going to change. Doesn't matter who's in the White House.
Yeah. And then there's, you know, James Madison writing about this back in 1789. He said, you know, if impeachment doesn't happen in the House and Senate, if the people are truly awakened and truly realize the magnitude of the malfeasance, or maladministration was the word he used, then impeachment will happen in the court of public opinion. It's called an election. And I have a feeling that that's going to happen in the 2008 elections, that the Republicans are just going to get wiped out. And so time will tell.
We're not far away. It's within eyesight.
It is. It really is. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, for more news and audio clips and all kinds of cool stuff. Alan, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman with you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain.
6 minutes past the hour, the third hour of the Tom Hartman Program. That's me. Pleased to be here with you. Are we headed for single-party rule in the United States? Or, frankly, I don't think we are now. But was that the plan? Was that the plan? To subvert the Justice Department, the criminal justice system of this country, to support single-party rule? I think back over the history of industrialized nations over the last 50 years or so, certainly throughout my lifetime, and the only nations that I can think of where single-party rule was an instrument of the justice system, or the other way around, arguably, where the criminal justice system was used to enforce single-party rule, were those countries that we referred to as the communist states, the satellites of the Soviet Union itself. And yet it seems that, in my opinion, that's exactly what the White House and Karl Rove were up to, was trying to create single-party rule in the United States and create it on an ongoing basis, which at its core is the destruction of American democracy. Christy Harden Smith is a former attorney who was blogging live for FireDogLake.com throughout the Senate hearings on Kyle Sampson. She describes herself as a recovering attorney. Christy, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
A recovering attorney?
Yeah. I'm no longer practicing, so.
I see. Oh, okay. Well, it's great.
I'm blogging now.
Yeah, and it's great that you're doing it, and you bring the perspective of somebody who understands the legal system to this. A whole lot of things happened in this Kyle Sampson testimony. I have some specific points and questions that I'd like to toss out and get your response to, but first I'm curious what your take is on the biggest, you know, what really happened here yesterday.
Well, you know, it was funny. One of the commenters on my site said that yesterday was the Sampson testimony, but one of the commenters on my site today said that in looking at all of this, it was amazing that we'd gotten back to the point where the word fealty had been reintroduced into the political system in the United States. That essentially what the Bush administration was asking was that the U.S. attorneys either be loyal to them and, you know, in effect swear fealty to what they considered were important political positions, or they would be removed from their office, whether or not those positions were sustainable in terms of looking at the rule of law, you know, whether the law was what the Bush administration said they wanted them to do. And
you know,
that, I think, is really troubling.
Yeah, fealty is such an anachronistic word. I mean, it's probably most people don't even know the origins of it in feudal society. You want to just give us a 10-second definition?
Sure. I mean, it would be, you know, in feudal society, you'd have someone who was maybe the lord of, you know, a certain area of land, and those people who lived on that land had to swear to be loyal to the person who owned that particular plot, and they had to, you know, give part of their grain, and they had to fight for them when they were asked to. Everything was for that person. It wasn't the good of the community. It was only for the good of the person who, you know, owned the particular plot of land.
Right, and that person even had, in many European communities, the right of the first knight. I mean, it just got very bizarre, and absolute power over people.
Right,
and
right,
so,
which is not what we're supposed to have here. I mean, we fought a revolution in 1776 for a reason.
Yes, yes, and so we're back to fealty. It's incredible. So you were saying, I'm sorry, you.
Well, we were talking about this quite a bit, actually, today. We were going over, you know, a sort of review in one of my posts of what we had learned yesterday and additional information that's come out today. The former head of the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice wrote an op-ed in the LA Times today talking about the problems with civil rights enforcement and how instead of being enforced for the benefit of minority groups or women's groups or religious minority groups who may have had issues of oppression, that the Civil Rights Division had been converted to prosecuting voter fraud cases, which were very questionable and would be brought up essentially as a suppression issue in areas where they were expecting high Democratic voter turnout.
Right.
So, you know, they saw that in Florida, you know, and there were other areas of the country in Ohio, you know, where cases were brought. And that's just one more drop in the bucket of what's been done.
And they've been able to get away with talking about this in public because the average American doesn't understand the difference between voter fraud and election fraud, that the Republican Party has engaged in widespread election fraud over the years. In fact, for over 25 years, they've been operating under a restraining order to stop them from doing some of the things that they did in the 2004 election, a caging, for example. And whereas voter fraud is where, you know, an individual who doesn't have the right to vote tries to vote. And those cases are so rare. I think there's been one successful prosecution for voter fraud in the United States in the last couple of years.
There haven't been many. And a lot of them, you know, have been brought and then found to have been implemented basically by political opponents who
right.
were trying to, you know, pull an election result out long enough to be able to get the vote reversed or votes thrown out that their side would win. I mean, there are political tactics involved a lot of the time. I mean, when you have a true voter fraud case, a lot of times you don't have to take it to court because you have enough ability to show that there's a problem. Say, if you have a political pundit who votes in the wrong district in Florida, something like that.
You mean like Ann Coulter?
Yeah, that would be what I mean.
That's voter fraud.
That would be voter fraud. Yeah, and that should be prosecuted. If you are truly committing voter fraud, then it should be prosecuted. But if you're using it to politicize something, then the question comes, are you doing this because it's the right thing to do for justice, or are you doing this in order to pervert the way that Americans elect their representatives? And if it's the second aspect of it, then you're politicizing the rule of law. And that's
right. And the way this works is one person, say a felon who shouldn't be voting in Florida, gets prosecuted in Florida for that, an African-American felon. It makes all the headlines. And then one of these groups sends out a flyer, a pamphlet to everybody in the African-American community, as happened in Ohio in the 2004 election, that says, and it happened in Florida as well, that says, if you or any member of your family has parking tickets or has ever committed a crime and you show up to vote, you will be arrested. Now, this is not true, but, you know, unknown groups were distributing tens of thousands of flyers that said this, or letters to registered Democratic voters in African-American communities. And it was apparently effective at suppressing a certain percentage of the black vote.
There were actually allegations of that occurring in Connecticut, too, during the primary when Ned Lamont and Joe Lieberman were running against each other for the Senate primary in a lot of the areas in Hartford and some of the other urban areas in Connecticut. That was also happening, which,
right.
you know, it's unusual for it to happen in primary races, but that one was a very tight one. And clearly there was a lot of Republican interest in keeping Joe Lieberman in the Senate.
Yeah. We just have about 2 minutes left here. We're talking with Christy Harden-Smith, who blogs over at FireDogLake.com and sat through the Kyle Simpson hearing, or Sampson hearings, rather, and blogged through the whole thing. An attorney, Christy, 122 times, Sampson says, I don't know. This is starting to sound like mafia prosecutions.
One of my longtime readers termed it Rovenesia. That it seems like folks who are connected with Karl Rove seem to be having this problem of Rovenesia every time they're held to account for some problem that they've caused. One of the issues that I think keeps coming up again and again and again, and especially if you look at the prosecutors who were fired, almost all of them were from states where the voting was close in the 2004 presidential elections, or where voting was also close in terms of congressional or Senate races in the 2006 elections, and where they're likely to be battlegrounds in 2008, except for the attorneys in California. But all of the attorneys, the U.S. attorneys in California have been replaced at this point, every single one of them. And if you can get someone, in that state who's willing to politicize election issues and election fraud issues, then you have the potential to, in looking at the 56 electoral votes that California brings with it to ensure a presidential victory, if you can control those 56 votes.
And if they're willing to overlook whatever they were investigating with Jerry Lewis and some other Republicans.
Right.
Yeah, amazing. Christy Harden-Smith, you can read all about it over at FireDogLake.com. You're a great blog. You're doing great work. Christy, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Great talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination, or, at least clean elections. We really would settle for that as a starting point.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. Air America Radio, Tom Hartman with you. 21 minutes past the hour. Joseph Rich was the chief of the voting section in the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division. This is pretty high up, right? The head guy in the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division, the chief of the voting section of that from 1999, the last year and a half of the Clinton administration, through 2005. And this guy wrote an op-ed piece in the Los Angeles Times, in yesterday's Los Angeles Times, that is shocking. Absolutely shocking. He says, the scandal unfolding around the firing of the eight U.S. attorneys compels the conclusion that the Bush administration has rewarded loyalty over all else. I'm telling you, what we are seeing here is the return of the Politburo. He says a destructive pattern of partisan political actions at the Justice Department started long before this incident, this being the Gonzalez-Kyle Sampson U.S. attorney firings. He says, however, as those of us who worked in its civil rights division can attest. And then he goes through, he spent 35 years enforcing federal civil rights laws, particularly voting rights laws. He worked for John Mitchell, Ed Meese, Janet Reno. He goes through the whole thing. And he says, regardless of the administration, this is the whole, the last 35 years, and I would say probably arguably the last 100 years, regardless of the administration, the political appointees had respect for the experience and judgment of longtime civil servants. Under the Bush administration, however, all that has changed. This Justice Department, over the last 6 years, has ignored the advice of its staff and skewed aspects of law enforcement in ways that clearly were intended to influence the outcome of elections. Do you get this? The beating heart of democracy, our elections. Thomas Paine said, you know, without the election franchise, we have been reduced to tyranny. And here you have the Department of Justice working to influence the outcome of elections. This is absolutely mind-boggling. He says the pattern extends to hiring. He gives an example of people who were hired who shouldn't have been there. He says just consider this for a minute. The administration was also politicizing the career staff at the Justice Department. Outright hostility to career employees. These are people who, you know, they're just doing their job, right? Outright hostility to career employees who disagreed with the political appointees was evident early on. Now, keep in mind, the guy writing this was the chief of the voting section in the Justice Department through the first 5 years of the Bush administration. He says 7 career managers were removed in the Civil Rights Division. I personally was ordered. This is Joseph Rich writing in yesterday's Los Angeles Times. I personally was ordered to change performance evaluations of several attorneys under my supervision. I was told to include critical comments about those whose recommendations ran counter to the political will of the administration, and to improve evaluations of those who were politically favored. This is more than just political hijinks. This is more than just, you know, Karl Rove, when he was a young Republican, breaking into a Democrat's office and stealing his letterhead and printing free beer and girls, and, you know, everybody is invited, flyers, and passing them out to homeless people and in fraternities to disrupt a Democratic candidate's campaign rally, which, you know, Rove did back when he was 19 years old. This is more than, I mean, that was pretty bad, but this is far more than political activity. This is taking an agency of the federal government that was created to enforce the law, particularly those laws that have to do, in this case, in the case of Mr. Rich, those laws that have to do with our right to vote, and turning that agency upside down. This is Khrushchev all over again. I mean, this is... I, at the risk of sounding like I am not complaining about this. I am horrified by this. This is, frankly, you know, whether somebody lied to Congress or not, whether somebody was conspiring to fire somebody, the big picture here, the big frame, the giant crime, is taking an agency of the United States government that is supposed to impartially enforce the law, and asking them to use the law against Democrats and in favor of Republicans, and anybody in that agency who disagrees, to give them bad performance reviews so that they can be fired, and anybody who agrees, even if they're incompetent, to give them good performance reviews so they can be perpetuated. Up next is the U.S. government outsourcing its brain and your calls. 27 minutes past the hour.
Broadcasting, this is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. like stones all the people.
It's your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. Think for a minute about the former Soviet Union. I've been to Russia a number of times, both before and after the fall. And after the fall, I was doing some work in Kaliningrad with an international nonprofit group. Kaliningrad was one of those areas that was like so super top secret that you couldn't even get into it when it was the Soviet Union. It was, you know, one of these secure areas. And one of the people that I was working with there told me a story, and it's probably been a year since I told it on the air, I think. I'm not sure. If I tell this too often, let me know. But in any case, it's a great story. Told me this story about Khrushchev. And it illustrates this binary point about the Bush administration. The Khrushchev story was, and you can find variations of this all over the web. It is one of those stories that's, you know, so well known by everybody in Russia that it's taken on a life of its own. And, you know, it's like stories about Jack Kennedy and Marilyn Monroe or something. Khrushchev, after Stalin died, Khrushchev took power, and Khrushchev is, and it became very fashionable for the first couple of years after Stalin died to trash Stalin, because everybody, you know, everything was coming out, and everybody was realizing that Stalin, you know, was a psychopath and a mass murderer. And so, and Khrushchev had been in the Politburo for years under Stalin. He had been in their parliament. And so he's up there giving a speech, and there's, you know, the 400 or 500, whatever it is, members of the Politburo, the delegates, you know, sitting in the gallery, and he's giving this speech, and he's talking about, you know, what a bum Stalin was. And somebody in the back yells, "Why didn't you say that when you were sitting back here?" And Khrushchev, you know, looks around and says, "Who said that?" And there's no answer. And then he looks around with a bit of a snarl and says, "Who said that?" And now everybody's like holding their breath. Nobody is saying anything. And then he starts pounding his fist on the podium and goes, "Who said that?" And people, I mean, just everybody knows if they sneeze, they will go off to the concentration, you know, off to the gulag. Absolute silence. You could hear a pin drop. And after a long minute, Khrushchev smiles. And he says, "Now you know why when I sat in your seat, comrade, I did not speak out against Mr. Stalin." Now, the keys to single-party rule in the Soviet Union, the two great powers, the two things that allowed this to happen, were, number one, control of the justice system in the country so that they could use it against their political opponents and they could use it to reward their political allies. And number two, control over all government functions by a single party. You know, all the other government functions, which included, since it was, you know, the Soviet Union, included most economic functions. So if the government were to be outsourced, if the vast majority of government work were to be outsourced to very large corporations, then who actually runs our government? Are we still a democracy? Is this still the United States of America? On the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, the lead article is "The U.S. Government Outsourcing Its Brain." And they start out with a story about, you know, you visit this company, MITRE Corporation, and it's like walking into the NSA or the CIA headquarters. You got to go through this whole security thing. This is a private corporation. The chief executive of the company says, "There's no doubt that post 9/11, there's been more growth than we've experienced historically. In 2006, MITRE, a nonprofit that runs three federally funded research and development groups, says revenues topped $1 billion for the first time." This is just one company. And then Bernard Wasacki Jr., the fellow who wrote this article for the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, says the risks of this approach
He's quoting Warren Suss, a Jenktown, Pennsylvania consultant and expert on federal government outsourcing. He says, the risk, quoting this expert, is that the federal government could wind up outsourcing its brain. And then he says, the number of private federal contractors has soared to 7.5 million, four times bigger than the federal civilian workforce itself. There are four times more private contractors using our tax dollars to do the work that we have said is part of the commons and we want done than there are federal employees who are actually accountable to us. Federal employees have, you know, they have to go through civil service exams. There's this whole system to know that they're actually competent, that they're actually doing their job, that their first loyalty is to the United States and not to the almighty dollar. I mean, people go, the right wingers look, oh, these are union employees. How dare they? They've got good salaries. They've got pensions. They've got health care benefits. Yes, I want them to have that. I want them to be committed to their job. I want them to, you know, put on their green eye shade and do their nice, boring, methodical, take care of it, make sure that the Social Security checks are paid every single month. I want them to do their job rather than sitting around saying, gee, how can I get advantage over Joe? How can my division steal some business from that division? How can I make more profit? Which is the way the for-profit world works. Not that there's anything wrong with that in the private sector. But in the public sector, it should be public employees. Another example, this is an example. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Deepwater, awarded in 2002, is a 25-year program aimed at upgrading the Coast Guard's boats, aircraft, and communication systems. The contract was awarded to a joint venture of Lockheed Martin Corp. and Northrop Grumman Corp. Unlike standard contractors, these contractors were given a bigger role in overseeing the project's many different strengths. See, typically, this would be handled, you know, the oversight of this thing would be handled by people who are answerable to us. They simply said to the contractor, yeah, you figure out how to, and as he goes on, he says, this is from the article in the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Skinner says his office found that the top decision makers were contractors, not civil servants. The Coast Guard was relegated to the role of advisor. Now, this is for a program for the Coast Guard. They were relegated to the role of advisor on technical matters, were essentially shut out of decisions on subcontracts, partly as a result, quoting from the Wall Street Journal, partly as a result, he says, the cost of the first two large arm boats called cutters is expected to be well beyond the $775 million original estimate. Well, of course it's going to be more than that. You've got to make sure that the stockholders are getting their 10% dividends so that they only have to pay 15% income tax because after all they're stockholders. You have to be sure that the CEOs have their gold-plated faucets in the bathrooms on their private jets. You got to, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And then the kicker, this is toward the end of the article, Fairfax County, this is one of these places where all these contractors are aggregating to provide services to the government. Fairfax County is now home to 358 foreign-owned companies. Some of which have been lured by the county's Economic Development Authority, which have five overseas offices. Recently, Camaro Inc., for example, a unit of the Tel Aviv company, set up shop in Tyson's Corner so it can better promote a radar system that can see through brick or concrete walls. And it's not, many of these are not even American companies. Four times more employees, contractors, than federal employees. We are losing our government. And it all goes back to Ronald Reagan coming into office and saying, there shouldn't be a federal government for all practical purposes. There are no good people in government. If there were, they would have been hired by private industry. That's a verbatim quote from Ronald Reagan. The damage that has been done to this country by 26 years of the Grover Norquist mentality is inestimable. I mean, it's mind-boggling. Curtis in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Curtis, welcome to the program.
Tom?
Yeah, hey, Curtis, you're on the
air. Hi, how are you? You know, I can't agree more with what you're saying. It's almost like looking at footprints in the snow.
Yeah.
If you go out after a clear snow day and you see footprints and you follow them, you'll find a rabbit or you'll find something following a rabbit, but one way you're being led. And what's happening, I think, is that not only is this part of a long laid out plan, but it makes sense in a way that if we stop and think and talk about it, it'll be much more valuable to us in the long run. For example, the way World Trade Organization, NAFTA and GATT, were ways for American corporations to gather and use the natural resources, the labor, whatever they wanted. Yes, and we outsourced our technology to them to do it, as you just mentioned.
Yeah.
And then the banking institutions, funding the government, our nation came into existence because France and Spain loaned us money to fight England when we went through that process.
Yeah.
Today we've got corporations here in our country, labor unions, suppression, work distribution of jobs for Americans out to other countries, the natural resources, even the education of Americans is becoming much more costly. It is
absolutely nuts, and it all goes back to this bizarre philosophy that Ronald Reagan brought into office.
Absolutely.
Came into office in 1980.
Listening to you just now, I said, my God, he's walking right down the same path that after 69 years I've had to look at. And it makes so much skin, it's frightening. There's electronic voting machines, which means anything that we do can be maneuvered, and people were talked into supporting those things. We know you.
Oh, I know, and they still are. And it goes on and on and on. Curtis, you're spot on right, and I thank you for the call. 45 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on the True People's Radio.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
What a wonderful world. Hey, special thanks, so many thanks to my producer David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Julian Sukman and Lauren Kirshner at Air America New York, and all the folks at Air America New York who helped make this program happen, to Ben and Shelby at White Rose Society, RadioPower.org, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, Mike Toth, who does our audio archives over on our website at TomHartman.com, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you so much. By the way, yesterday when I was in San Francisco, somebody came up, afterwards we were doing a book signing, and somebody came up and said, you know, how can I support your program? And I said, support our advertisers. And she said, well, you know, I don't need to buy a car, and I don't, you know, or she mentioned a couple of things that were advertisers on that particular radio station on the Quake. And she said, you know, I just don't need to buy those particular things. And I said, just call them up and let them know that you're listening and that you will recommend them to your friends who may need their products. Even if you're not going to buy them, even if you can't buy them or you don't need them. And she's like, you're kidding. I should call the advertisers and let them know I'm listening. I was like, yeah. And Bob Agnew, the PD or GM, or I'm not sure Bob's title, the big cheese at the radio station was sitting next to me. He goes, yeah, that's a big deal. That's really a big deal. So, you know, if you want to support Progressive Talk Radio, it's really, you know, obviously, you know, this is supported. This is commercial radio. It's supported by our sponsors. But they're supported by you, buying their products, recommending their products, and perhaps just as important, letting them know that you're actually listening. 1-866-303-2270 is our telephone number. And Christian in Dummerstown, Vermont, on the line. Hey, Christian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Vermont misses you. We hope Oregon's treating you well.
Well, thank you. Some of us refer to Oregon as Vermont West. I remember when I was in Vermont, my kids referred to it as Oregon East, and I think there's a lot of parallels here. I miss Vermont, and I'm loving Oregon. So,
great. Well, I was listening to you and Ellen Radner talk about investigations into impeachment, and Ellen Radner says a lot of the same things on our local radio station WKVT, and it's really interesting because, in the sense that I feel like many people out there still think impeachment as if it's the third rail of politics, or even, I just feel like there's so much information that's still not known about there that people aren't aware about, even within the 38 towns that passed the impeachment resolution. And one of the things is that one of the common misconceptions is that people say, oh, we need to focus on more important issues like healthcare, education, the war, and so on and so forth. But from my understanding, at least during the Watergate hearings, my impression was that they not only did they establish the EPA, but they also passed the Endangered Species Act. So they are capable of walking and chewing gum at the same time. And I feel like if they can do it back then, they can do it now. And the other thing
I agree, and I think that the argument that this would distract Congress is the weakest of the arguments. The real argument here, Christian, I think that there's a political calculus at work, and that is that, as I said earlier, that the Democrats all know that when there's a consensus among the American people that the president has actually committed high crimes and misdemeanors, then you can actually have a successful, not just impeachment, but conviction in the Senate. And then you'll have a Nixon moment where the president just says, okay, that's it, we're out of here, just like with Nixon. Whereas on the other hand, if there's not that consensus, as was the case with Clinton, then what you have is, you know, I think that it frankly hurt the Republicans. They ended up looking like fools. You know, it hurt Clinton. It slowed some things down. It certainly slowed down his agenda, which was one of the Republican goals. But I think that there was a price to be paid for it. And so if you go into impeachment before the American people believe that the guy really is a crook, you shoot yourself in the foot. And if you say that any of your hearings are designed to lead to impeachment, you destroy their credibility. So no, in my opinion, no Democratic politician, or for that matter, an independent like Bernie, should be saying right now, gee, this is, you know, what we're all about is trying to impeach the president. Instead, what they should be saying is, we're trying to find out if there were crimes committed here.
Exactly.
And then if the answer is yes, then you say, oh, there's crimes. I wonder if they're impeachable crimes. And then you've got the ball rolling. But if you start out by saying, you know, we're going to impeach the president, now let's have a hearing, you know, nobody's going to take the hearing seriously because you've announced in advance it's a witch hunt.
Well,
just doesn't work that way.
One of the interesting things that I found out is that the party that leads the investigations of impeachment is the party that wins the next election. And I've noticed it's a pattern because who was the president after Andrew Johnson? Ulysses Grant. Who was the president after Herbert Hoover when they tried to investigate into impeachment for him? It was FDR. Same thing with Truman. Who was next? It was Dwight Eisenhower. And then Nixon, we rest our case. It was Jimmy Carter. And then we all know what happened in 2000. And it just seems like it would work to their advantage. And on top of that, if you look at the polls...
I agree, but see, in each one of those cases, they thought they had a crime that was worthy of impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in Andrew Johnson's case, it was his firing Stanton, the Secretary of War.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about Herbert Hoover.
That was in John Nichols' book, The Genius of Impeachment.
Yeah, I'll have to go back and read that. What was it about around the Hoovervilles, about his attacking the and the Bonus Army and all that? Or
yes, with Truman, it had to do with going after the steel workers.
Oh yeah, okay, interesting. See, that's the thing. You've got to have that smoking gun. You've got to have that specific crime that you're looking at. Christian, your point is well taken and well said. I've got to move along. I appreciate it. We just have a minute before we've got to wrap up the show here today. Bob in New York City, you had an example of outsourcing in civil service you wanted to share.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I used to work for the New York City Board of Education, and I ran the call center. Half of the call agents were civil servants, and half of them were temporary, quote-unquote, outsourced agents. And we paid them twice what we paid the civil servants, even though they had better benefits. And some of them had been temporary for 5 years. So there was no cost savings.
This was just cronyism with a company that was friends of somebody on the board or something?
No, I just think that they were against increasing headcount. And so they thought they were getting around it, and they were just shooting themselves in the foot.
Yeah, amazing. Bob, thanks a lot. I mean, this is where, you know, ideology reigns and everything else is destroyed. Coming up tomorrow or Monday on the next Tom Hartman program, conservative Harry Binswanger and I are going to debate legalizing price fixing. Bill McKibben is here on his new book, Deep Ecology, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a wonderful and safe weekend. We'll see you on Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.